Welcome to The Point on WCAI. I'm Steve Junker. It's Friday, July 6th. This is our weekly news roundup when we discuss some of the top local news stories of the week with our colleagues in the print and digital media. Joining me in the studio from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. Good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
And from the Falmouth Enterprise, we have Emily Rogers. Good morning, Emily.
Good morning.
And later in the program, we'll be joined by Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. We'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Andy Tomolonis at SouthCoastToday.com. And now a look at some of the news here on the Cape and the islands. Cindy, in Falmouth, some residents are growing increasingly worried over a plan to locate a drug rehabilitation facility next to an elementary school.
Yeah, that's Morris Pond School, and that's Gosnold. Gosnold would like to build a drug rehabilitation hospital next to the school, and that would boost the number of beds from 50 to 99, and also increase the number of beds that they're using for detox. Now, families have objections to this because they say it's right next to the school. On Tuesday, there was a demonstration in front of Town Hall. Children came with their parents, and there are also people from residents of a senior housing complex on Rosemore Lane that backs up to the proposed Gosnold hospital site.
So the site is next to the school and a senior housing complex.
Yes, yeah, and it's a former nursing home, so that's what makes it like that. What Gosnold says is an ideal location, but residents of the area and parents are objecting.
So what are some of the concerns that the parents are bringing up?
Well, they're concerned about safety. They're concerned about patients actually wandering away. And actually, residents are concerned about that, too. Residents are saying, you know, when there was a nursing home, the people wandered away, and they're afraid that patients would come looking for prescription drugs or cash. And the parents are concerned. They say they're concerned about child safety. This would also have a unit that would be dedicated to – it would be a secure unit, but would also have mental health people with dual diagnoses of substance abuse and mental health. And one parent, Jessica Morrison, says she's sympathetic about the need for services, but there are other places it could go.
There is a substantial need for services, I don't think anyone would argue, and this represents an increase in size for Gosnold if they were able to move into this facility.
Yes, and there's just been such a crying need on the Cape and elsewhere with the opioid crisis. There's such a dire need for an increased number of beds and detox units, and so this is something where it's the argument is about where it's, you know, where it should be located.
So tell us a little bit about the demonstration that was some parents and their children came out this week in front of Town Hall in Falmouth.
Yeah, that was in front of Town Hall. It was on Tuesday, and parents and some children came out, and they said that they're about to start Morris Pond School, fifth grade, in the fall, and they were nervous about it. A man leading the opposition to the Gosnold plan says that a lot of parents are planning on actually choosing school choice and moving the kids out of district if this plan goes forward. He said Michael Halen said he knows about 60 families who plan to move, and he said that could cost the school district about $500,000 because they take the money with them if they, you know, when they move out of the district, they take a certain amount of money per pupil with them with school choice.
And these parents have been circulating petitions.
Yes, they have a paper petition and also an online petition that has garnered more than 500 signatures.
What happens next with this, do you think?
Well, Gosnold held a meeting in June, a community meeting forum in June, and they're planning on hosting another one. And they're also, the Falmouth Police Chief Edward Dunn plans to meet with concerned residents on July 16th. And Richard Kirkrew, he's the Gosnold president CEO, said that any meetings so far between Gosnold and town officials have been simply to gather information because they have to go before the zoning board. So there hasn't been anything, you know, secretive going on. He says it's just they're just talking about the information that Gosnold needs to go forward with this proposal.
And the zoning board says that they've only had very preliminary conversations.
Right. This is nothing really official has happened yet. This is all very preliminary.
Let's talk about we've had a couple of drowning and near-drowning incidents reported lately. I want to talk about a near-drowning that happened at a hotel pool last Friday and involved a young boy. What do we know about what happened?
Well, luckily, this was a happy ending. The boy was fine. It was a little visitor from Ireland, Jonah McGuire. He was 7 years old, and he was in the Seacrest Beach Hotel's outdoor pool. On Friday, he was pulled from the deep end by a swimmer who saw the child lying unconscious at the bottom. I don't know if I'll pronounce this man's name correctly, but he deserves some recognition. Mm-hmm. That's Christopher Okonfolami, and he's 37, from Cranston. He placed the child on the edge of the pool, and he yelled for help. And what came out this Tuesday, this week, was a police report documenting what actually happened during this incident.
Sounds like this Christopher Okonfolami was swimming and saw the child at the bottom of the pool, and he swam down to get the child. Is that right?
That's correct. That's correct. And also the Falmouth Acting Assistant Health Agent, Bernard Sullivan, said the clarity of the pool is acceptable, but there's room for improvement. The hotel also had not installed separate floats that separate the deep and the shallow ends of the pool. And from what the police report said, that the child's mother and sister were on the beach area where a family friend was watching Jonah and her own granddaughter, and her granddaughter was in the shallow end, and Jonah was jumping in and out of the 6-foot end. And when this occurred, and there was like no like special marker to indicate that he was actually at the deeper end of the pool. So, and the DPH inspected it on Monday. There was 2 days after the pool reopened because the pool was just closed very briefly.
It indicates how quickly these things can happen in a swimming pool. This is a crowded pool outside, and very quickly this happens.
Yes, and another thing to remember is that health officials say that children do not splash around and call for help when they drown. They just kind of sink. They may reach out an arm and then just, like, sink. Mm. And that's so you really have to be aware of, like, any keep your eyes on the children and also be aware of anybody at the bottom of the pool. And if it's a crowded pool, of course, you know, people just go by quickly and don't even notice because kids dive to the bottom of the pool all the time. But so you really need to have eyes on at all times.
Now, last summer we had an incident where there was a drowning of a young boy, and I think it really raised the at a swimming pool in Falmouth, and it raised the awareness of pool safety within Falmouth, which has been trying to write some rules around this.
Yes, that was a 4-year-old boy who drowned in the Cape Cod Camp Resort and Cabins, and that was in August. And the town of Falmouth did adopt new rules for hotels and campsites that have pools, but they are not requiring a lifeguard, and there was no lifeguard at the Seacrest pool. But the boy's father, Jonah's father, put on Facebook that he was supposed to be released from the hospital on Tuesday, and he thanked everybody from the bottom of his heart and said that he's fine. So thank goodness.
Let's speak now with Emily Rogers, who's with us from the Falmouth Enterprise. Good morning, Emily.
Good morning.
We have you have a story out in the Enterprise today. You spent a day in Washington, D.C. with our Congressman Bill Keating. Sounds like it was a pretty typical day for him and quite a busy day. Give us a sense of what a congressman's schedule is like.
The day that I spent with Congressman Keating was a little bit special because he was kicking off a new congressional caucus focused on counterterrorism efforts. So we went to that event, but we also went to a Foreign Affairs Committee hearing. We met with a few constituents, and we...
I know there was a big vote on
yes,
that day.
Yes, there was a big vote as well, but I was unable to attend that. But there was lots of discussion about it throughout the day.
Mm-hmm. And the Capitol, I know, is connected to the Congressional Office Building by an underground train. You mentioned taking this train. I've always been fascinated by this. Were you able to ride the train with the congressman?
Yes, I was. It was, you know, kind of fun. It wasn't anything like taking the metro in D.C., but, you know, it was kind of fun.
And what was your sense of the congressman, of his ability to do the work for our district in Washington, D.C.? Does he feel like it's going, he has opportunities to continue to press the Capes, you know, what we're looking for the Cape?
Yes. Well, he was just able to pass some legislation regarding the Cranberry District, which he was very excited about. And so I think he's hopeful that he will be able to continue doing really good work for his district, but he definitely feels that there is pushback because he is not in the majority of the House.
So this is such a nice opportunity to go and follow a congressman and bring this story back for people to understand what's happening in Congress with our congressman. What were you surprised by spending a day in Washington, D.C. with Congressman Keating?
Well, I mean, I obviously knew he would be very busy, but I don't think I totally was expecting the fast pace of the day and how they really went from one thing to another, and there was lots of running through the halls, and there was a little bit of back and forth. Like, he went to the Foreign Affairs Committee hearing and sat there and listened for a while, but he also then he ran back and then to his office, and then he ran back again. So there was lots of back and forth throughout the day.
So it's a fast-paced move, and he's surrounded by his aides at the same time, his staff,
yes.
I should say. Yeah. Emily Rogers from the Falmouth Enterprise, a nice story in the Falmouth Enterprise about Congressman Keating, a day with him in Washington, D.C. People can check it out in the Enterprise. Thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
We're going to speak now with Sarah Brown at the Vineyard Gazette. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning.
Sarah, we spoke a couple of weeks ago about the shoaling in the channel at Lake Tajmu. There was some talk then about the possibility of dredging this summer. You've got an update on this for us. What's happening?
Yeah, as you mentioned, we had the story in June about Lake Tajmu, which is a popular spot. I think about 290 people have moorings there, and it is a popular location, especially in the summer, prime sailing time. But because of lapsed permits, the channel wasn't dredged last fall or winter, and it's now impassable at low tide for some boats that have, it's I think, about a 3-foot clearance. So right now they're working on trying to dredge it, but there's really a tangle of logistical and bureaucratic issues to sort out that's proving pretty tough, but both the town of Tisbury and now the town of Edgartown are trying to sort this out. The Edgartown comes into play because the town of Edgartown has a dredge. That's good news. The bad news is right now it's being stored in the town barn, which is where it is off-season, because the dredging season is traditionally more in the winter. It's 30 tons, and to get it into the sea, you would need a crane and a tractor trailer, and that has to be hired from off-island. They have to be brought over on the ferry, and apparently because those two things are so heavy, they would have to take separate ferries. So that's one logistical thing. And then once you get a crane and a tractor trailer here, you have to hoist it and tow it and get it into Katama Bay, the dredge into Katama Bay, and then tow it over to Tajmu. So that's one logistical issue. This certainly has its expenses, too, to rent the crane and to get it where it needs to go, and also the ferry reservations, I'm sure. And then there's another issue of, you know, the staff of the dredge. Usually they are not working so much in the summer, but Donnie Benefit, who is a commercial fisherman, you know, this is his busy time. He said that he's willing to dredge he's the dredge operator too. He said he's willing to do it. He said he doesn't like going to meetings, but he said that he's ready to do it. That's the end of that. They just need to sort it out. So that's a good thing. But there's also the issue of some piping plovers. There are two nests near Tajmu. One of them is incubating eggs, and so they're expected to hatch maybe July 15th, July 17th. You can dredge in the area apparently while they're still nesting, because there, of course, are protected species, mm-hmm. and there are, you know, all those regulations. Once they hatch, though, the dredge spoils and the front-end loaders could endanger the chicks. So there's a window of time maybe between July 15th before then to dredge. So that's another issue.
That's not
it takes
long.
3 or 4 days.
That's not long from now, July 15th.
Not at all, no. And it would take about, they said, 3 or 4 days, so you'd have to start by around July 11th. So that is, very soon. So right now there's kind of a rush to figure out if this can be worked out. And, you know, some people are, you know, frustrated about this. Apparently the harbor master said one person ran aground last month, but there has been another issue since. But there's certainly some frustration and a desire to do it now. You know, regardless, this area will be dredged in the fall. But there's right now trying to sort this out, mess out to get it dredged before then.
And there are boats with deeper drafts that can only go in and out, they say, right now on a high tide, or that they're very
exactly.
leery of going out on a low tide.
Exactly, yeah. And some people, you know, who are, people are reluctant to even try at low tide, and certainly people are avoiding the area. So it is an issue, especially for larger boats.
Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette. Sarah, thanks for bringing us up to date on that.
You're welcome. Thank you.
This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us from the Cape Cod Times, Cindy McCormick. We're going to the break now. When we come back, we'll speak with Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. It's more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. And on the phone with us right now is Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning, Steve.
Tim, a new bike path may be in the works that would link Chatham and Orleans, a connection that's not so easy right now for bicyclists. It sounds like a great idea, but I understand it may not be so straightforward.
That's correct. This has been something under discussion for a long time, for many years. Excuse me. It's sort of the golden ring for local bikers to get from Chatham and Orleans in a direct way. Right now, if you want to bike from between Chatham and Orleans, you either have to take the Old Colony and Cape Cod Rail Trails through Harwich and Brewster, which is an 18-mile trip, or you have to risk biking along the really heavily traveled roads like Route 28, which go between Chatham and Orleans. And of course, especially at this time of year, that can be pretty dangerous. Now, last month, bikeway committees from Chatham, Orleans, Brewster, and Harwich got together to discuss regional planning efforts, and a Chatham-Orleans bike path was a pretty prominent part of that discussion. Now, also attending this meeting was Tom Francis, who's deputy director of the nonprofit group Mass Bike, and he showed the group a map which displayed the most popular biking routes in the area. And while the established bike path and the roadways are well used, there's a small but pretty regular group of bikers who use the Eversource utility right-of-way, which runs sort of parallel to Route 28 between Chatham and Orleans. It's a distance of about 6 or 7 miles. Now, this is an unpaved path, obviously, underneath the utility poles. Now, in other communities, these sort of rights-of-ways are being eyed for bike paths. And Francis suggested that local bikeways officials explore the way some way to do that here. Now, this, as you said, Steve, it's kind of got a lot of impediments to it. There's a couple major road crossings they'd have to develop a way to get across. There's they'd have to develop a way to get across Muddy Creek, which is between Chatham and Harwich. But Francis said he thinks that this type of trail could really help boost bike ridership in the area and help draw visitors here, too. But aside from those other difficulties, the really biggest impediment here is that 90% of this right-of-way is privately owned, and, you know, Eversource has just an easement over it, and the towns would have to negotiate their own easement in addition to that, or take the land, which, you know, probably wouldn't go over pretty very big here. But Francis said that the right-of-way is now being used by bikers. Converting into a bike path would benefit the communities by also reducing or eliminating the need for pesticide spraying along this particular corridor, which we know has been controversial in the past several years. Because if you pave it, you know, you take away some vegetation, clear some on the other sides of the path, and you have less area that has to be controlled. Now, while there appears to be some demand for this, bikeways officials really have no illusions that this is going to take a while to develop. After all, the Old Colony Rail Trail that runs between Chatham and Harwich, which is about the same distance as this and was developed over, you know, the old railroad beds, which were mostly town-owned, that process took about 20 years. So It's not an easy process to go through, but it looks like there's some interest in it here, and the bikeway committees say they're going to continue to explore it.
And some momentum behind trying to establish these bike paths these days.
Yeah, well, you know, biking is seen as an alternative mode of transportation for people getting to work. If you created a really direct way to get from Chatham and Orleans, I think that would really improve safety, because you get a lot of those people off the road, especially Route 28. If you know it along Pleasant Bay, it's pretty twisty and turny, and there's not a lot of room on there for bikes to share the road with cars. And there's a lot of, you know, some of the J1 workers who are here seasonally who don't drive ride bikes, and they work in Orleans and Chatham and Harwich. So the you know, easier way to get them from one place to another would certainly improve safety and help things a bit.
Tim Wood of the Cape Cod Chronicle. Tim, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, in Wellfleet, the town lawyer is saying that the first phase of the Herring River restoration will pose a low risk for liability lawsuits. It's an issue that had some folks worried.
This is from attorney Greg Corbo. He's from KP Law in Boston, and he represents the town of Wellfleet. And he reversed his earlier prediction in a letter saying that earlier he had predicted there was a high risk of six-figure lawsuits from this this project, which will involve restoring the river so that this dike is removed and the water will flood, the tides will flood land and restore it to its natural flushing capability and restore ecological health to the area. Of course, this is, you know, raises the possibility of lawsuits as people's land is flooded. But he said that most of these parcels of property that will be subjected to higher tides are already considered non-buildable wetlands. So he's saying much really lower risk of lawsuits than he originally predicted.
And the town of Truro is part of this project in a big way, but is maybe withdrawing from the first phase of the project, it sounds like.
Well, this is going to be a $50 million restoration project, and this is Wellfleet and Truro, and also the National Park Service. This is sort of a combined local, state, and federal effort. It would be the biggest salt marsh restoration project ever attempted from Maine to New York.
And covering a huge amount of area as well, more than 1,100 acres.
And the first phase is about 560 acres. And this whole situation is caused by the 1909 construction of a dike at the mouth of the estuary. And the plan is that this is going to improve the river water quality, rare species habitat, recreational opportunities, and also help the estuary adapt to climate change. So it sounds like a win-win. But Corbo is saying that, you know, he's not ruling out the future possibility of lawsuits. So this, you know, could still be a controversial topic.
Last weekend saw a number of local protests alongside national protests focusing on immigration policies.
And there are at least 16 sites on Cape Cod where protests took place, including there was one at the Hannes Airport Rotary on Saturday. And this was part of a wave of protests across the country. People want an end to the Trump administration's policy of separating children from parents at the U.S. border with Mexico and other entry points. And they want immediate reunification of these children with their parents because the Trump administration has reverse policy on this. And they also want support for the families who are dealing with trauma because they're saying this is a very traumatic separation of, in some cases, very young children from their families.
So at least 16 protests happened on the Cape on Saturday. Your reporter Marianne Bragg was out, and what did she learn speaking to some of the protesters?
Well, she went to the Hyannis site, and she was speaking with Moira Bunchen from Hyannis, who was there with her two daughters, who are 8 and 10. And Moira said, "We feel it's our right and our duty to talk about things that are wrong." There, she also spoke to Janet Jochum, the former Barnstable Town Council member, who talked about a very local angle, because she said there's a real serious concern about the sheriff's relationship with ICE. Last year, the Barnstable County Sheriff's Office became a delegated immigration enforcement authority. And this was with a partnership with ICE. That's a state and local law enforcement partnership with ICE. And four Barnstable County officers, sheriff's officers, recently completed training in North Carolina. And the first inmate, a Brazilian national, has been referred to the local agency.
Mm. So a lot of concern about that right there. And the protests happening last weekend. Anything else from that?
And they were organized by a bunch of different groups. A lot of people came together for these protests, including the Cape Cod Women for Change and Indivisible Outer Cape and several others.
Let's move on. And we've been following the efforts to protect endangered right whales. A story out this week about a local test for a piece of equipment that may help keep the whales from becoming entangled in fishing gear.
Yes, this is the ropeless buoy equipment to catch lobsters. And the International Fund for Animal Welfare in Yarmouthport is paying $30,000 for the test of this ropeless equipment by one member of the Massachusetts Lobstermen's Association in July, possibly in Cape Cod Bay. They're talking about having a commercial fisherman from Sandwich actually test this equipment.
And this is a piece of equipment that's been used elsewhere.
Yeah, it's been used. It's sonar technology that's now used in commercial fishing for the Australian southern rock lobster. And what it is, you know, the typical lobster gear here has a surface buoy and a vertical rope that attaches to the seafloor. And that's where the whales can become tangled within and wounded and killed by these ropes. What this would do, this is interesting, they would use a bottom anchored mesh bag would be full of ropes and floats that would open and pop to the surface with an acoustic command from the boat. So no rope.
And this is just one fisherman testing this one piece of gear, is that right?
Yeah, but there are also plans in the pipeline to test some equipment, an inflatable bag that would bring lobster traps to the surface. And the whole plan is to avoid these catastrophic collisions or intercepts with the North Atlantic right whale, because it's 17 died in U.S. and Canadian waters last year, which was pretty, you know, which was 4% of their population. So this is of the population of 450 right whales, North Atlantic right whales in the world. So this is pretty tragic and catastrophic for them. So there's most of them are due to fishing entanglements and also ship strikes. And as a matter of fact, the sole documented death of a North Atlantic right whale, which is off Virginia this year, was linked to this chronic entanglement.
Mm. And we should mention that the lobster landings in Massachusetts, I was impressed to learn this from this article, are second only to scallops as the highest value landings of seafood in Massachusetts. So it's a big, big industry.
It's a huge industry. The landings in 2016 in Massachusetts were valued at $82 million. That's according to the National Marine Fisheries Service. And that year, the state issued 1,500 coastal offshore and seasonal lobster permits.
We're going to speak now with Casey Myers at the Provincetown Banner. Good morning, Casey.
Morning, Steve. Morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
Casey, you have a fascinating story about how Provincetown's historic district is beginning to come to terms with the effects of climate change. You know, the Banner story starts with a close look at one house in particular. Tell us about this house and the people who bought it.
Okay, sure. This is Roe and Eleanor Panizzi. They bought 71 Commercial Street, which is a beautiful antique in the west end of town, and they soon found out, since they were going to do a substantial renovation, which is... that is, the cost of the renovation exceeds 50% of the original cost of the structure. Since they were doing that level of a renovation, that triggers the FEMA flood hazard regulations. They would have to lift their home by 4 feet. And Provincetown, its situation is not unique to them. Provincetown has 511 buildings that are listed on the National Register of Historic Homes. Most of them are on the waterfront, or many of them are on the waterfront. So there's at least a dozen homes that are going through this process right now where they're getting such renovations that they also need to be lifted. So this raises a lot of issues, and what happened in the Panizzi's case was they lifted their house by 4 feet. It added $150,000 to $200,000 to the cost of their renovation to do this, to raise it up. And now they have water that will flow underneath their home in the case of flooding, which it did. And they said, they told us that their neighbors who have not had their homes lifted both lost, I think they lost their boilers. And yet these people were fine, which is great. But you can see with $150,000 to $200,000 in additional cost, this is a real burden for many, many property owners. So... It's raising a lot of questions in Provincetown, and it also raises a lot of questions in the neighborhoods where, let's say, the person who lives on the water in front of you blocking your water access, now they've lifted their home. The water will now flow during a flood towards your home. And
the water can now flow, can flow across the street, essentially. It flows under the waterfront homes onto the second line homes.
Exactly. And then there's the more typical issue of you're lifting a house by 4 feet. Now you're blocking other people's water views. And go ahead.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, when what happens to a historic district that gets lifted 4 feet? I mean, you're changing the character of the downtown in the historic district. It's quite a question.
It is a very big question. And I was surprised to learn that there are no guidelines. There's no uniform standards for how to design for these lifted homes. I assumed that there would be some guidelines written down at this point by the Historic District Commission or somewhere on what they should do, what property owners should do in terms of screening, or do they put lattice, mm-hmm. or do they put a certain particular material? And there really isn't. Everything is done on a case-by-case basis. So this is really a kind of a big deal, and Provincetown's just beginning to deal with it.
And it also means that financially, it really is only available to people who can afford to do this.
Yeah, and that's a big question. How many people can afford to buy a waterfront home in Provincetown anyway? But let's say you've owned one, inherited one, had one for generations in your family, and it desperately needs renovations. Now you're looking at $150,000 to $200,000 in added cost. That cuts a lot of people out of the market. And there's a lot of talk of changing the demographics even more because of that. And also with historic properties, these houses are very fragile. heavy, fragile, saturated with old wood.
Mm-hmm.
And so as one preservation planner said in our story, a lot of these properties have been sitting on the sand since God was a lad. So you're talking about just really fragile. Who knows if they'll withstand it even.
Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner. Casey, thanks for joining us with that story.
Okay, thank you.
Cindy McCormick is here from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, another story we've been following, the town of Brewster has been in some upheaval. The town administrator resigned last month. We have some news about the search for a replacement.
Well, it's down to two people, Mark Forrest, Yarmouth Sleckman. He was the former Provincetown town manager, and former Brewster Sleckman, James Foley. Now, the Board of Selectmen subcommittee did reach out to seven individuals, but got five rejections from people. And so they're saying it was the time of year. This is a time of year when people want to enjoy themselves, people who have experience in this area or who could be considered more like, nope, we want the summer off.
And this is for an interim town administrator, we should make clear.
Yeah, this is for definitely the interim. This is after town minister Michael Embry resigned last month. And right now they have an assistant town administrator, Susan Broderick, who is actually the acting town administrator at this time. But the select board hopes to hire a part-time interim town administrator for 4 to 6 months.
So they went out, they got identified seven people. They've got quickly narrowed down to two because five of them said no.
Right. They're both experienced candidates, but it's just down to the two of them.
And one of them is a selectman already former selectman.
Mark Forrest, a Yarmouth selectman and former Provincetown town manager. And then James Foley is the former Brewster selectman. And the board is also starting the process of searching for a full-time town administrator.
We are going to go to the break now. This is the News Roundup. I'm Steve Junker. With us is from the Cape Cod Times, it's Cindy McCormick. When we come back from the break, we'll be speaking with George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times. We'll have more in a moment. Welcome back. This is the News Roundup on The Point. We're discussing the top local news stories of the week. I'm Steve Junker. Joining me from the Cape Cod Times is Cindy McCormick. On the phone with us right now from the Martha's Vineyard Times is George Brennan. Good morning, George.
Good morning, Steve, and good morning, Cindy.
Good morning.
George, the island has been in the news this week in connection with well-known attorney Alan Dershowitz. This is, in its own way, quite a story. Tell us what this is about.
Yeah, well, there's always fireworks on the 4th of July, right? But it was Alan Dershowitz creating the fireworks early in the week. Just a little backstory, Steve. Every reporter's dread is to have a story happen in their backyard and not know what's happening. And certainly that didn't happen to me, but I was wondering if it did when I looked at Twitter on Monday night and I saw Martha's Vineyard was trending. The initial pang in my heart, I clicked in and saw that it had to do with a piece that Alan Dershowitz had written for The Hill, where he complained that he was not being invited to any gatherings or some of the gatherings he's used to being invited to on the island. He was being shunned by people because he's gone on network interview shows and defended Trump, at least in the constitutional sense.
The Hill is a Washington-based publication.
That's correct. And so it was trending on Twitter, and most of the people were mocking him, saying, "Oh, poor Alan Dershowitz, he's not being invited to these social gatherings. I guess he's going to have to pack up and go to the Hamptons to find his safe space." Or, you know, there were all kinds of tweets like that. And so right away I'm thinking, oh, we have to become a part of this story. We have to find out what's going on. And so the next morning I came in and I was able to find a cell phone number for Alan Dershowitz, and I dialed him up and he gave an interview, and quite interesting. He talked at length about how he could care less about being invited to parties, but he's just saddened that, you know, this is happening on Martha's Vineyard. Traditionally, he says it's been a place where, you know, people would come and they'd leave their politics on the mainland and, you know, people could get along here, and both Republicans and Democrats. And, you know, there was no litmus test of, you know, who was going to be invited to a party. And of course, Dershowitz you know, for other reasons, people in the past, you know, have taken issue with who he's defended. He's, of course, known for defending Claus von Bülow in a Newport high-profile murder case, and he was actually able to get Claus von Bülow exonerated. And, of course, he was part of the so-called dream team in the O.J. Simpson case. So he has quite a reputation that precedes him anyway. And here he is defending, you know, someone in Donald Trump who has certainly created a divide in the country, you know, regardless of what you think of Donald Trump's politics, there's no question that people are more divided than they've ever been on party lines.
And Dershowitz wasn't, he seemed to take pains to say that he had not voted for Donald Trump, didn't support him, but he was sort of defending what, his right to do what he's doing?
Absolutely. You know, he said, that he donated all kinds of money to Hillary Clinton, that he voted for her, and he wanted to make that absolutely clear that this isn't about Donald Trump's politics. In fact, he disagrees with Donald Trump on immigration and other issues, but he makes a point of saying that constitutionally, you know, there's a difference in how he's being treated, particularly with the Mueller investigation. So, just a couple of side notes on this whole thing. You know, this became a huge story where the New York Times picked up on it and wrote about it. They actually quoted our interview with Alan Dershowitz and linked to the story, which was a pretty big deal. In our daily newsletter that we do called The Minute, we did a poll of our readers, and it was interesting. We asked them, you know, would you invite Alan Dershowitz to dinner? And it garnered hundreds of responses. We've done these kinds of polls before, and you get some response. But this time, you know, everybody seemed had an opinion on it. 37% said they would invite him to dinner, and 63% said absolutely not. So that was a pretty interesting take as well. And we've gotten more comments on the story than any other story we've ever had. And again, they're very much divided, as you might expect. Entertaining to read nonetheless.
Yes, I was going to mention the comments below the story. People should take a look at that. George Brennan from the Martha's Vineyard Times. George, thanks for joining us this morning.
Thanks so much, Steve. And Steve,
yes.
If you want to come over to the island, we will not shun you. You're
okay.
Invited anytime.
All right, I appreciate that. That makes me feel better. Thanks, George. We'll talk to you next
take
week.
Care. Bye-bye.
Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. I want to also follow up on the Brewster story that we were just talking about, the interim town administrator there. Also, your reporter Ethan Genter writes about how Brewster is having to delay a couple of projects because of what appear to be accounting mistakes.
Yeah, this is a big whoopsie. They thought they had money in the books for the projects to improve the Long Pond boat ramp and Upper Mill Pond, improve the water quality there. But a review of the fiscal 2018 book shows that the money isn't actually there. And they thought it was there about like $260,000 basically left over from previous projects that have been improved in 2015. But an auditor said the money is not available. So the select board had to vote on Monday to put the brakes on the projects.
Now, the auditor has been looking at the town for a little bit here, and this is just part of a larger process of looking at what's been happening there.
Yeah, there have been a string of errors that have been uncovered in the town books by the Abrahams Group, which is a consultant that the town hired, and to look at the books line by line.
Do they have any sense of how this error happened?
They say they don't. Right now it's a mystery. And the finance director is on medical leave at the time. And, of course, the town administrator, you know, Michael Embury, is out of the picture right now. So right now this is a mystery as to how this happened. I mean, it happens with people's checkbooks, but we don't know how it happened in this case of the town of Brewster. There's also another – Abrams also discovered a $400,000 deficit with the general debt reserve. So there's so Brewster's trying to get to the bottom of this.
Let's speak now with Andy Tomolonis at SouthCoastToday.com and the New Bedford Standard Times. Good morning, Andy.
Hi, Steve.
Andy, you've got a story that's got some positive news in the response to the opioid crisis. This comes out of a South Coast story from back in the winter. I guess it involves ambulances and the use of Tylenol.
Yeah, so let me back up just a little bit and put some context into this. So last year we ran a lot of stories and editorials about the choices that EMTs could legally offer the paramedics when they were administering pain relief to trauma victims. And they really had just two options. One was ice, or I guess they use a cold pack, and the other was an opioid, which was either morphine or fentanyl, but most typically fentanyl. So EMTs and personnel in Acushnet, they thought it was a little bit crazy that they were being forced to give fentanyl, you know, in the middle of a nationwide opioid epidemic. So they wanted to do something about it, and they studied the use of intravenous acetaminophen in Europe and elsewhere. And the fire chief in Acushnet, Kevin Gallagher, brought the idea to Dr. Matthew Bivens, who's the director of emergency medical services at St. Luke's Hospital in New Bedford. And Bivens made his case to the state, and the state medical services committee ended up making it state policy. So as of January 1st, ambulances around Massachusetts, everywhere in Massachusetts, are required to carry IV acetaminophen or Tylenol, brand name Tylenol, as an option for treating pain. And after it became policy, we were hearing stories that it was working pretty well to relieve pain in many situations. And now that it's July, we looked at the first 6 months of use. And for the first 6 months of 2018, the number of instances in which fentanyl was administered as a pain reliever, it dropped by 51% in our communities. So that's just New Bedford, Fairhaven, and Acushnet, the three communities that are served by St. Luke's emergency room. And so it's very good news. It's a drop from the same number from last year. So Acushnet Fire Chief Kevin Gallagher told a reporter that from January to the end of June, fentanyl administrations were down collectively in New Bedford and Acushnet and Fairhaven from 129 uses in 2017, the first 6 months of 2017, to 63 in the first 6 months of 2018. That's a significant drop.
Yeah.
Yes. And the decrease is attributed to the change in protocol. And it's an important trend, really, because fentanyl and other opioids, you know, they're blamed for many of the addiction problems in South Coast and elsewhere. And you've probably written and read and talked about it, that the new path to addiction often begins with prescription opioids. So medical officials cite a common trend, too, that when EMTs prescribe opioids for pain, doctors in the emergency room often follow suit, mm-hmm. you know, and recommend the same thing. So that by stopping the use of opioids in an ambulance, it can also lower the prescription of opioids. The emergency room doctors, of course, are better prepared to make those decisions, but they often go with the recommendations of EMTs. So that's really interesting. And there are some trends, of course, where they will use fentanyl because for severe trauma, broken bones, and other things. But the IV Tylenol has been working very well. Chief Gallagher in Acushnet told us it relieves pain and it isn't addictive. And in Acushnet, the EMTs or the paramedics, they've administered more doses of IV Tylenol this year than fentanyl during the first 6 months of this year. And Gallagher said that nobody has yet complained.
Mm-hmm.
So, That's all good. And there's another interesting development that's happening here, and that's the dropping of the pain scale. If you've ever had a toothache or a broken arm, a sprained ankle or a sore back, you've probably been asked by a doctor to rate your pain on a scale of 1 to 10. So Bivens, Matthew Bivens from the emergency services at St. Luke's, said paramedics stopped the practice earlier this year because many patients will instinctively rate their pain at 9 or 10, you know, even if it's a toothache or a bloody nose or a wrist. It's just a frustration with this predicament.
Mm-hmm.
So we've also been told that many doctors don't like the pain scale for the same reason, because it encourages higher doses of painkiller. And, you know, they tell us that pain is there for a reason. It stops you from moving and doing, you know, and hurting yourself further. And so pain relievers should ease the pain, but probably not eliminate it entirely. So it's an interesting story. And we've got it at southcoasttoday.com if you want to really read a little bit more.
Andy Tomolonis of southcoasttoday.com and the New Bedford Standard Times. Andy, thanks for that.
Thank you.
Cindy McCormick is with me from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, a story out of Provincetown that involves members of the Select Board in Facebook and the state's open meeting law. Explain what's happening here.
Well, this is a new wrinkle on the open meeting law. It's social media, involves social media. A Provincetown resident, Michael LaChapelle, filed a complaint about saying that three members of the Provincetown Select Board, that's three out of five, belong to a closed Facebook group called the Provincetown Women's Collective. And he accused the women of possibly deliberating board matters in this private Facebook group. Now, the town council, Michelle Randoza, has issued an email saying that they did not violate the state's open meeting law and that they weren't really on the Facebook page talking about matters before the board.
So these three members of a closed Facebook group, and now what happens? They don't have to get out of the closed Facebook group, it sounds like.
Well, it's interesting. The three members are Louise Vendon, Lisa King, and Cheryl Andrews. And King said she wasn't even aware that Vendon was even in the group. Mm-hmm. But what happens next is that the select board will come before the select board, and they'll vote on Randoza's response on July 9th. And then LaChapelle can then ask the state's attorney general's office to review decision, because he said he really wants the state attorney general to take a look at this and not just the local authorities. He said his quote was, "Do you want your public officials posting in secret groups so you can't see what they say on items before them?" And so that does raise a question. It doesn't mean that the women were doing this, but it raises the possibility of what does go on in these private Facebook groups if the public has no access to them.
One more unexamined consequence, perhaps, of social media.
Absolutely.
A couple of nice animal stories to end the week here, and I want to start with the turtles. Let's talk about loggerhead turtles and five of them. Tell us about these.
Well, it was very exciting. This five loggerhead turtles were released at West Dennis Beach on Monday. There was a crowd of 100 cheering them on, and volunteers who had patrolled the beaches in late fall, you know, finding the cold stunned turtles, were also on hand to release the turtles. And normally, hundreds of these rehab turtles are released in the South. So this is sort of a rare treat that they're released right here on Cape Cod and Nantucket Sound as the loggerhead turtles actually return to the area. So they'll be joining their fellows who had the sense to head south. Well, these turtles stuck around, and they were stunned by the cold. Remember the very extreme cold temperatures we had, mm-hmm, in the spell November to December in the 20s, and wind chill, horrible wind chills. And some of these turtles will just hunker on the bottom, get covered with algae. Their respiratory rates will just slow down. This one turtle they called Laser Lemon was taking one breath every 7 minutes. That's what the scientists say. And they also, they're cold-blooded animals, so they just don't move and they can die. But these turtles were rescued, and they wintered over at the New England Aquarium's Animal Care Center in Quincy, and were really coaxed and really not babied, but they were very much treated very well. They were fed herring and squid and giving antibiotics. So in some cases, pneumonia took months to treat, and they were also like coaxed to swim and eat. And Laser Lemon put on 27 pounds, and we was 77 pounds at release, although the average weight gain was 10 pounds. And so this was just a very happy occasion when the turtles were released. And all five have been outfitted with satellite tracking tags so scientists can determine how long they will live following their rehabilitation.
I was amazed to think that these turtles have been in rehabilitation for 6-7 months, I guess, right?
Right. Yes, yeah. Yes. And then, but they, you know, try not to handle them or anything like that. You know what I mean? But they look so much better. You know, they were emaciated. Some of them were covered with this algae, and they just look healthy. And then some of them actually, as they were, you know, volunteers were hoisting them out to the water, actually began paddling in the air, you know, just in anticipation. And they're a huge, great beast. But then once they got in the water, they just look so graceful and they take off. And it was, and hopefully they'll live long, happy lives and avoid the hook of Cape Cod. It can confuse turtles of different species because they get caught within the hook, mm-hmm, and they also get confused by the warmer waters of the bay. And then, of course, once they want to start migrating south, it's like, oh, very cold.
There's a great photograph of the turtle making its way to the water with what looks like a crowd of paparazzi around it.
That's right, exactly.
Taking pictures of it.
People were very happy to participate in that release.
Cindy McCormick from the Cape Cod Times. Cindy, thank you for joining me.
You're welcome.
And thank you to Sarah Brown from the Vineyard Gazette, Tim Wood at the Cape Cod Chronicle, Emily Rogers from the Falmouth Enterprise, Casey Myers from the Provincetown Banner, George Brennan at the Martha's Vineyard Times, and Andy Tomolonis from SouthCoastToday.com. Thank you for listening. I'm Steve Junker.